This is part two. How is it that you not see the beauty in each being? I'm going to skip the intros and outros because it'll be at least a few part series, so easier to get right to it. Princeton University Press, author James Q. Wattman, Hitler's American Model, the United States, and the Making of Nazi Race Law. Chapter one of two long chapters in the book. Various subsections. This chapter one is Making Nazi Flags and Nazi Citizens. It is a curiosity to pick up the New York Times for September 16th, 1935. The lead article for that day reported on one of the darkest moments in the history of modern racism with the following headline, bolded and in large type, Reich adopts swastika as nation's official flag, Hitler's reply to insult. This was how the Times, like most other American newspapers, reported on the promulgation one day earlier of the most infamous piece of race legislation of the interwar era, the Nazi Nuremberg Laws. Only below did the paper add, in less aggressive type, a reference to what we remember and revile about Nuremberg, anti-Jewish laws passed, non-Aryans, deprived of citizenship and right to intermarry. These were the measures we call the Nuremberg Laws today, the measures that signaled the full-scale creation of a racist state in a Germany on the road to the Holocaust. Why weren't the American headlines about them? The answer has to do with the political genesis of the Nuremberg Laws, and it testifies to the complexity and ambivalence of relations between Nazi Germany and New Deal America in the early 1930s. There were moments during the frightening and uncertain years from 33 to 36 when Nazis' views of the United States were marked by anti-American resentment, hatred toward American Jews, and contempt for American constitutional values. But there were also moments when Nazis expressed hope for a good future of good relations and a belief in the kinship between the U.S. and Germany as countries both committed to maintaining, quote, Nordic, end quote, supremacy. The September 16th headlines in the American press had to do with the case of Nazi hatred toward American Jews. The Nuremberg Laws were indeed presented to the world as Nazi Germany's response to an insult to the swastika flag, and the insult in question had taken place in New York City. This was the so-called Bremen incident of late July 1935, when rioters ripped the swastika from the German ocean liner SS Bremen. The rioters were arrested, only to be released by a Jewish magistrate named Louis Brodsky. It was in response to Brodsky's decision that the Nazis proclaimed the first of the three Nuremberg Laws, the Reich Flag Law, which enshrined the swastika as the exclusive national emblem of Germany. The triumph of the swastika in Germany can thus be said to symbolize, to some degree, the Nazi rejection of the liberal currents in American life and of the place of Jews in American society. But the other two Nuremberg Laws, those that deprived German Jews of the right of citizenship and the right to intermarry, the ones we remember as today as the Nuremberg Laws, were different. They were not presented to the world as a rejection of America. In fact, when Hitler and Göring proclaimed the two new anti-Jewish laws at Nuremberg, they did so in speeches that were decorated with expressions of friendship toward the Roosevelt administration and the U.S. And the uncomfortable truth, as we shall see in this chapter and the next, is that the two anti-Jewish measures that we call the Nuremberg Laws today, far from marking a German rejection of all American values, were crafted in an atmosphere of considerable interest in and respect for what the example of American race law had to offer. And they brought German law significantly closer in line with American law than had previously been the case. And as mentioned in part one, the book is dedicated to the ghost of Louis B. Brodsky. And then he goes into the first Nuremberg Law of New York Jews and Nazi flags. When we speak of the Nuremberg Laws today, we, like Germans of the Nazi era, refer only to the second and third out of the three. These two were the citizenship law, which subjected Jews to a form of second-class citizenship, and the blood law, which criminalized marriage and sexual relations between Jews and Aryans. Nevertheless, there were indeed three laws proclaimed at what the Nazis called the Party Rally of Freedom at Nuremberg on September 15, 1935, and in describing the politics of Nuremberg and America's place in the Nazi legal mind of the 30s, it is appropriate to begin where the American newspapers began, with the first of them. Something in German, the Reichsflaggengesetz, the flag law for the Reich, and the Bremen incident that provoked it. The history of flag law is a window into the murky currents and countercurrents of hostility and tentative amity that characterized Nazi attitudes towards New Deal America in the early 30s. And at one point, the U.S. State Department made an effort to calm the situation, sending a note expressing its regret that the German national emblem should not have received the respect to which it is entitled. Whatever hostility to Hitler there may have been in the streets of New York, the administration was anxious at this point in its history to maintain good relations with the Third Reich. Nevertheless, throughout the late summer, the German press kept matters at a boil. The crisis reached its climax on September 6, a week before the opening ceremonies of the Nuremberg rally, when Manhattan magistrate Louis Brodsky ordered the release of the five arrested rioters while delivering a fiery opinion denouncing Nazism in the name of American freedoms. Louis Brodsky, the New York Jew who triggered the Nuremberg Law, was an improbable protagonist in an international diplomatic crisis. His career was shaped by both the opportunities and the obstacles that early 20th century America presented to Jews. He graduated from NYU Law School in 1901 at the remarkable age of 17. But Jewish lawyers did not find it easy to make their way into prestigious law firms or judgeships in early 20th century America. It was certainly infinitely better to be a Jewish lawyer in the U.S. than in Nazi Germany, but it was still tough, as the Nazi literature of early 30s gleefully observed, and Brodsky took a different route. Through the sponsorship of Tammany Hall, the corrupt New York Democratic political machine that often promoted the interests of ethnic minorities, he landed a patronage job as a magistrate in the lower Manhattan detention center known as the Tombs. Brodsky may have been a beneficiary of Tammany Hall politics, but he, like other Tammany figures, was an ardent champion of American constitutional rights. In 1931, he stirred up a scandal by permitting the distribution of pornographic novels. In April 35, he made headlines again when he released two nude dancers who had been arrested at a Greenwich Village club, declaring from his police court bench heroically that, quote, nudity is no longer considered indecent, end quote. On the same night, another magistrate had no difficulty charging nude dancers busted at Minsky's Burlesque. And when Bremen rioters came before him in early September, Brodsky seized on the opportunity to proclaim the values of America and denounce the Nazis. The swastika, he wrote, was a black flag of piracy, and it stood for everything the U.S. opposed. So fascinatingly, this is part of why this book is so fascinating, because I guess, like a lot of people, the history knowing of the war is just, you know, the evil Germans over there. And so to find out that, you know, they came to America before they became full-fledged Nazis, and that there was this sort of dance of like and dislike going on with the U.S. Is just, to me, that's a major news. And then he mentions Minister of Propaganda Joseph Goebbels. The infamous Goebbels had already decided to use the Brodsky opinion for Nazi political purposes. I'm just going to kind of skip a little bit here, because otherwise you can just read the whole book, really. It's that good. As we all know, events rapidly proved them wrong. Within weeks after Hitler took office on January 30th, 1933, the Nazis were well on their way to full domination. In the course of the familiar nightmare sequence that marked Germany's descent into dictatorship, the Reichstag fire of February 27, the elections of March 5th, and finally the enabling act of March 24th, which conferred dictatorial authority on Hitler. And I think the Reichstag, that's the false flag, which has been compared to other events in recent history, say U.S. events, false flag stuff. So it was that the Nuremberg Laws were offered to the world as a reply to an insult delivered by a Jewish magistrate in a Manhattan police court. But it is important to emphasize that they were not offered as a rejection of everything America stood for. It was perfectly possible to denounce the New York Jew Louis Brodsky without denouncing America. New York City, after all, as one German author observed in 1935, a book written in praise of FDR, had very little to do with America. New York was a place where, quote, the representatives of the races, end quote, gathered together to create a mishmash of ideas and people, a place marked by a great influence of the Jews, which made institutions like Columbia University centers of radicalism. The true America, by contrast, was Anglo-Saxon and Protestant. German racists had been saying similar derisive things about Jewish New York City for years. Well, again, there's that, I'll call the populist imperialist schizoidness of, you know, just pluses and minuses about America and how that gets used in a lot of times to implement minuses. And have the Nazis saying that their quarrel with the Jews was not with the U.S. Hitler made a point of pausing in his address on the new laws to praise the Roosevelt administration for its thoroughly decent and honorable disavowal of Brodsky. The Nuremberg laws, he explained, were intended to simply to serve as a rebuke to Jewish elements everywhere and as a confirmation of the correctness of National Socialism. Goering, in his own speech for formally presenting the new laws, added that Germany could only express its sympathy for the American people. After all, Americans, since they did not benefit from anti-Jewish laws of their own, had been forced to witness the indecent display of insolence by the uppity Jew, Brodsky. Of course, no Nazi speech should ever be taken at face value. Nevertheless, the Nuremberg addresses of Hitler and Goering, with their studious effort to show respect toward the Roosevelt administration and their nasty bid for the support of American anti-Semites, fit with what we know from many sources. In 1935, Nazi attitudes toward the U.S. had by no means yet hardened into unambiguous hostility, any more than Washington was yet ready to write off coexistence with Hitler. In the careful judgment of historian Philip Gassert, for example, it was only beginning in 1936 at the very earliest, and especially in 37, that the U.S. would finally lose its role as a model in Nazi Germany. That is not to suggest that relations between the two countries were wholly harmonious in the early 30s, or that the Nazis saw nothing to hate. So it goes on to explain the places where they connect and the places where they don't connect. He cites a fair amount of texts, which is interesting to see, you know, that this insanity, you know, is based on various texts. And he cites this book, Volkisch World History, A Global History for Nazi Readers, with a stock portrait of Hitler. Opening pages, the most important event in the history of the states of the second millennium up until the First World War was the founding of the U.S. of America. The struggle of the Aryans for world domination received thereby its strongest prop. So, you know, there's a lot of that reference to America, sort of this in this long-range scheme of Aryan and world domination, and so that's a whole kind of topic there in itself. Here they have, we all know that many of the founders of the U.S. held beliefs that we now find reprehensible, but it still takes one's breath away a bit to find a Nazi describing the founding as a historic turning point in the, quote, the Aryan struggle for world domination, end quote. According to Warold Drescher, for example, author of the handsomely printed 1936 tome titled The Supremacy of the White Race, the founding was, quote, the first fateful turning point, end quote, in the worldwide rise of white supremacy. America had assumed the leadership of white peoples after World War I, fulfilling the promise of centuries of American racism, and if it were not for the contribution of the Americas, a conscious unity of the white race would never have emerged. Some quotes in there. Such sentiments were echoed, for example, by the leading Nazi ideologue Alfred Rosenberg in 1933. Whereas Hitler himself put it in a ringing passage, the racially pure and still unmixed German has risen to become master of the American continent, and he will remain the master as long as he does not fall victim to racial pollution. While there's a mix of these, you know, stuff going on, it must be noted that there's this underlying, horrific underlying thing about master race and white supremacy, so that, you know, you can't overlook that, and it's quite pertinent with what's going on today in the world. All right, I'm inside in case the sound sounds different. To be sure, we must keep our composure when we encounter Nazi pronouncements about America like these and the many more from which I will quote in the following pages. If there was a great deal of praise for American white supremacy in Germany in the early 30s, it was also commonplace to speculate the U.S. might well fail to achieve its historic racist mission. Even the Nazis, most favorably inclined, were unsure that they could count on American friendship in the long term. When the National Socialist Monthly published a special number on the USA and us in November 33, for example, it trumpeted Germany's affinities with the Americans at some points, but at others it voiced uncertainty about the future course of American development, as well as expressing anger at the ugly stories the American press had published. So again, the mixed bag. When the Nazi observers looked out on early New Deal America, they saw a country where white supremacy ran deep, at least once the visitor left New York City behind. And while it is hard to know how many Anglo-Saxon Americans would have been receptive to Goring's speech in 35, there were certainly many who did indeed regard people like Brodsky as uppity Jews. As for the two Nazi anti-Jewish measures that we remember today as the Nuremberg Laws, they were crafted in an atmosphere marked by the same tentative and uncertain spirit of kinship with America. Hard though it may be for us to accept it today, the Nuremberg Laws were the products of many months of Nazi discussion and debate that included regular, studious, and often admiring engagement with the race law of the U.S. And then it gets into the second Nuremberg Law, making Nazi citizens. The two anti-Jewish measures we call the Nuremberg Laws. The first of them, the Reich Citizenship Law, commonly called the Citizenship Law, established a distinction between citizens of the Reich, Reichsbürger, and mere nationals, I'm not even going to try to pronounce the German. Its aim was to restrict full political rights to members of the German Volk, the mystically understood national German race community. The adjective form Volkisch. A national is any person who belongs to here's the Reich Citizenship Law. A national is any person who belongs to the Mutual Protection Association of the German Reich and who owes special duties in return. Nationality is acquired through the provisions of the law of members on membership in the Reich and the state. So these laws continue. A Reich citizen is exclusively a national of German blood or racially related blood who demonstrates through his conduct that he is willing and suited to faithfully serve the German Volk and Reich. 2. The right of Reich citizenship is acquired through the conferral of the brevet of Reich citizenship. 3. The Reich citizenship is the sole bearer of full political rights to be exercised according to the measure of the laws. German blood, German honor, commonly called the blood law, banned mixed marriages and sexual relations between Jews and Germans, as well as the employment by Jews of German women as household servants. It made two distinct provisions about mixed marriages. First, that they were void as a matter of civil law, and second, that they constituted a criminal offense. The blood law also included a sarcastic provision permitting Jews to fly their own Jewish flag. When Goring read that provision out at the rally, the assembled Reichstag delegates, it is reported, roared with laughter. The blood law left unresolved the difficult question of who counted as a Jew. So, wow, I gotta make a couple comments there. One is that, like, it's just effing insane, this whole psychology of trying to control and label people based on, you know, nationality, race, blood, etc., etc. And then the other thing, it's, in a way, it's hilarious to me as a I have German heritage and Jewish, so I don't know what that has done to my psychology over the years. Perhaps that's helped make me who I am today. And then here's a section, Law on the Protection of German Blood and German Honor. They voted the following, blah, blah, blah. Marriages between Jews and nationals of German blood or racially related blood are forbidden. If such marriages are nevertheless entered into, they are null and void, even if they are concluded abroad in order to evade this law. Actions to nullify such marriages are brought by the state prosecutor. Extramarital intercourse between Jews and nationals of German blood, blah, 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 forbidden. Jews may not employ female nationals of German blood or racially related blood under the age of 45 in their household. Jews are forbidden to raise the Reich and national flag and to display the colors of the Reich. Whatever it is. However, they are permitted to display Jewish colors. The exercise of this right stands under the protection of the state. Any person who violates the prohibition of, number one, shall be punished by imprisonment at hard labor. Any male who violates the prohibition of, number two, shall be punished either by ordinary imprisonment or by imprisonment at hard labor. Any person who violates the prohibition of three or four shall be punished by ordinary imprisonment for up to a year and by a fine or by either of those penalties. This Between the Lines did a series on the new Jim Crow, so I don't know what the exact parallels are, but heck, there's some parallels there for sure. And the other thing is, it's mentioned throughout the book too, unintentionally humorous, is sort of these comments about how it's easier, how do you tell who somebody is, and that the U.S. with the racism against blacks, it's like obvious to know, but it's not always so obvious with the in Germany it wasn't so obvious who's who. After Goring had finished reading these ugly decrees, reported the New York Herald Tribune, a Republican newspaper that was one of the few to headline the racism of the Nuremberg laws, the assembled Reichstag members, 600 odd men, the bulk of them in brown uniforms, leapt to their feet in a display of enthusiasm. The question we must ask is whether the Nazis gleaned any American inspiration in the making of this program of persecution. Here it is essential that we begin by posing the question correctly. We must recognize what the Nuremberg laws did not say, and conversely what American law of the era did say. The Nuremberg laws did not aim to set up a system of segregation or apartheid. Their twofold purpose was to create a new Nazi law of citizenship alongside a new Nazi law of sex and intermarriage, which I will call the American name miscegenation. As for America, citizenship and miscegenation were both central to American interwar race law. Segregation was only part of it. That's when it starts to get technically legal. The last point deserves some emphasis. When Americans think about their legal history of race today, they can find it hard to shake off the fascination with Jim Crow segregation in the South. In the 1950s, Brown versus Board of Education became the pivot on which our understanding of modern race law turned. And we have commonly framed American race questions around the conflict between Brown and Plessy versus Ferguson ever since. In the American collective memory, race law involves first and foremost separate schools, separate water fountains, seating at the back of the bus, and so on. The practices that triggered the great sit-ins, protests, and violent clashes of the early civil rights era. The identification of race law with segregation has shaped all of the English language literature on American influence in Germany. That is why, when scholars have wondered whether American race law influenced the Nazis, what they have wondered about is the significance of American segregation laws. But there was always much more to American race law than segregation, as the Europeans of the interwar period well knew. And we will not understand how Nazi lawyers viewed Nordic America unless we bear that fact in mind. American race law pre-Brown sprawled over a wide range of technically distinct legal areas, including not only separate but equal segregation under the rule of Plessy, but also Indian law, anti-Chinese and Japanese legislation, and disabilities in civil procedure and election law. America was particularly notable for its creation of novel forms of de facto and de jure J-U-R-E, second-class citizenship for blacks, Native Americans, Filipinos, and Puerto Ricans. Anti-miscegenation laws on the state level featured especially prominently. They would be eliminated only at the tail end of the Civil Rights era with Loving versus Virginia in 1967. So did immigration and naturalization law on the federal level. De facto race-based immigration and naturalization practices would survive until the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965, coming into effect only in 68. Some aspects of this extensive body of American race law were closely linked to eugenics. Immigration and anti-miscegenation laws in particular were often described as measures related to the eugenic maintenance of a racially healthy population. Other aspects, however, like segregation and the creation of forms of second-class citizenship, had nothing to do with eugenics as such. They represented a different mode of exclusion and persecution involving legal degradation rather than population engineering. And in all of these areas, the U.S. stood out for the energy and innovativeness of its law. Early 20th century, America was the global leader in race law, admired around the world for the vigor of its legislation. In this, the Nazis were not alone. As in so many areas, this was one where American creativity shone. I don't know why that's not in quotes, but, you know, sort of pseudo-quotes. Anyway, that's a key thing there in the first, up to page 35, 34 there, that, it wasn't just the race laws, but there are these layers of laws, and he goes on to say how various states may have handled things differently. And then the next section is America, the global leader in racist immigration law. And then it gets into American second-class citizenship. And the Nazis pick up the thread. I find that one of the most fascinating things to in the book for what it's saying, to get beyond all the specific labels of Nazi and America, is this thread of psychology that I think both things need to be looked at to see that from the, you know, the overview, the human being perspective of all the relations with Mother Earth, that it's beyond these labels of Nazi and America. As I get older and I learn the history, I realize, okay, how is some of this nonsense gonna be, you know, where might it go in the future? So I think that's why I think that's important to keep that, you know, the thread in mind, because ultimately it's, you know, the thread finds a home in the psychology somewhere, or it doesn't. And so, but, you know, we can't lose sight of the specific places in either. Then it goes on to, toward the citizenship law, Nazis look to American second-class citizenship, and then a bit more there before that first chapter is concluded, but that's a good place to stop for now. Again, emphasizing that there's these layers to the law, and that's another thing that astounded me with the book, is the level of studiousness that happened. And I, I've said it before that I feel like, from observing, there's this kind of two-pronged insanity when you look at the, you know, with the empire today, just the sheer military and brutality side, and then there's this legalistic fine print, I don't know whether you call it studied side, but this very manipulation of words and stuff that runs the laws, and these little loopholes and all kinds of BS that is like this other side of that coin. And you know, we hear it when we hear politicians talk nonsense. The things they say, Clinton saying it depends on what the definition of is, and Rumsfeld saying there are known unknowns and unknown knowns, and whoever it was, Rove or somebody, who said that we create reality, we're the reality creators, and we create reality, and you've got to study us, and we're constantly changing. It's like, you know, this not only just out of their minds, but also somewhat, you know, the meticulousness of in their minds, and the meticulousness with which a lot of the horrors are perpetrated. So that's a whole other side angle of psychology and analysis. But that's it for now with part two. So thanks for listening. Keep the peace and have a good one.